Hello, everybody. Welcome to week four section. My name is Tommy MacWilliam, and today we'll be going over Android resources, animation, and intents. So these are kind of three topics we kind of glazed over during lecture, and we're going to be taking a look at them in more detail today. So usual announcement that the lecture videos are always available at thesite.net/lectures, and we have a new section schedule. So as Dan mentioned in lecture, we will have section every week in here right after lecture. And so during section, we'll be going over lecture topics more in depth and maybe covering some extra material that would have been nice to cover in lecture but not strictly necessary for projects, just cool stuff. Office hours will be every week a project is due on Tuesday and Wednesday nights. Locations will be posted to the homepage as soon as we know them. There will also be walkthroughs for the two remaining staff's choice projects. So there will be a walkthrough this Thursday, time and location to be determined. That will be also posted on the course website. And there will be another walkthrough for the iOS staff's choice project. On weeks we don't have walkthroughs, we're also going to be offering seminars led by each of our TFs and the kind of areas of the TF's expertise. So maybe something that's not on a project, but something the TF has worked with a lot in Android or iOS. So just kind of a fun opportunity to learn something really in-depth that's not covered in the syllabus. And finally, we have kind of merged our online section and our lab component. So distance and non-distance students alike are welcome to attend online sections. Again, times are posted, and we'll be going over some hands-on examples so you can follow along in your home computer. So any questions with the new schedule? Sure. Yeah, so the question is, will the labs be posted? All of the online stuff is recorded automatically, and they'll also be posted, yes, along with source code. So walkthroughs are kind of a opportunity to give you a starting point for these projects. So we know we're throwing a lot at you. Maybe you don't really know where to start. So a walkthrough is going to take you through the basic steps that you need to complete your application, kind of a high-level overview. Maybe you go into a little more depth on kind of the trickier parts of it. But the idea is so that we're not just leaving you stranded with the really kind of short specification, you have no idea what to do, we kind of want to guide you along to get you on the right track. All right, so let's jump in. So today we're going over resources, so the non-code data and integrating that into your app. I'm not doing mobile web dev anymore. Along with styles, which are kind of like the CSS equivalent for Android, as well as animations, and intent filters, so how to launch other activities both within your app and within other apps. So as always, I have a feedback page. Feel free to let me know if you hate the color of my slides. So first, let's talk about resources. So resources are anything that are not Java code. So all of our resources are going to be placed in a special directory in our project called RES. So when Eclipse compiles your project, it's going to automatically put everything inside of this RES folder inside of the APK, so you don't have to worry about not having an image on your app because it's on your laptop. So this directory is organized by subdirectories. So there's a lot of separate folders where you can put things based on what type of data it is. So among these are anim, where you're going to put all of your animations. So we'll take a look at what's going in that directory later. Color, so these are colors used to determine the states of UI elements, so you can define the color a button changes when it's pressed, for example. Drawables, so these are all your bitmap images, so like your pings, your GIFs, whatever. We already looked at layouts, where we're going to put all of our XML for layouts. Menu, we'll be taking a look at next week, how to generate a menu when a user clicks a certain button on their phone. Raw is going to be any resource you need to read in raw, so without doing any parsing. So if this were a text file or for some reason you wanted the raw bytes of an image, if you put it in raw, then you can access it without Android trying to parse it or do anything fancy with it. And finally, XML, which are some other configuration files, which we'll be taking a look at not this week but later. So there, to access resources, you can do it in both Java and XML. So we saw today in XML, the way to access a resource is with this at, then what type the resource is, so whether that could be drawable or anim, it's going to correspond to that folder name, and then a backslash, and then the name of the resource. So for things like images, you can't really specify XML inside an image. That doesn't make any sense. So the name is just going to be the file name without the extension. So if you have something in your drawable called icon.png, that would be @res/drawable, at drawable/ and then icon without the PNG. So to access these from Java, we're going to use this special automatically generated R class. So same deal, we're just going to replace the type and the name with the type of resource we're accessing and then the file name in this case. There is also this special subfolder called values. And so values are generally all XML files that you're creating yourself, and so you kind of have full control over what's in them. So these file names can be whatever you want. One example of them is strings.xml, which we saw, and they can contain any XML you want. So the only condition is that everything inside one of these files has to have resources as its root element. So anything you define has to be a child of this resources element. So because the file name doesn't really make any sense anymore, because you know we're creating XML and we're not restricted to that file name, we can use the XML to specify things, we're now going to access via Java and XML from the element you specify. So if you have, for example, a child element, that's a child of resources, a color element, that's a child of resources, you would access that via r.color, and then the name is going to be an attribute that you give that element. So if you gave it a name of red, you could access it with r.color.red. And so same thing with XML, just replacing the r dot with the at and then the slash. So what's really cool about the Android is that we can actually specify different resources depending on the type of device. So this isn't really an issue for iPhone yet, I guess, because there's one iPhone and it has all the same specs. That's starting to be not so true because they have different resolutions. Anyway, with many different Android phones, we might want to display different resources depending on what type of phone is used. So to do that, we're going to use what's called resource qualifiers. This is what we took a look at with telling the difference between English and Spanish. We can also use these to take a look at the actual hardware specs of the device. So the first of these is language. So these are any valid ISO 639-1 code. So this is actually a standard put out by a body that is not Google. So there's just a link to all of the country codes and region codes. Next is going to be the screen size. So this is the actual physical dimensions of the screen. Next is the aspect ratio of the screen. And then the current orientation. So it's either portrait or landscape, depending on how the user is holding the phone. Next, we have pixel density. And so this LMH DPI is low, medium, high. XH DPI are like super high-res phones. Next is text input, so whether or not the phone has a QWERTY keyboard or it doesn't. And then other things, there's a lot more here, but another one is just navigation. So like the Nexus One happens to have a trackball. Not too many Android phones have a trackball, but that's something you can detect and you might want to respond to accordingly when you're displaying your UI. So all of these qualifiers have a precedence. So we looked at this on that slide, but the order they're presented here is in their precedence, and there's also many more, not only after these, but you know, in gaps, that's not so relevant. So there's a four-step process the Android device uses to determine which single folder it's going to use to display resources. So first thing it's going to do is just eliminate any flat-out contradictions. So if you have a folder for Spanish and your phone's in English, forget it. Next, it's going to go through all of these qualifiers in their order. So Google has this long list of qualifiers. It's going through that in order. As soon as there exists a folder that matches a qualifier, it's going to eliminate any contradictions. And so once this process is complete, there will be one folder remaining, and that's the folder that the Android device is going to use to display your resources. So let's take a look at how we can implement this. So here, I have a simple app. All I'm doing is creating a single image view. So this is a UI component that's used to display an image. So here, I'm using the find view by ID. I've given this image view an ID of image view, which we can take a look at. So right here, here's my image view. It has an ID of image view. I've also given it some padding. And I've given it this source, so this is just the image that's going to be shown by default, which I'm going to immediately change. So here, you notice that we are loading a single drawable called icon. However, we have all of these different folders. So I've created four drawable folders, one for each of the different pixel densities, and then one more that's a little more specific because we've said, I want this to match only if there's a trackball. So each of these folders contains a different color image. red, yellow, green, or blue. However, they're all named the same thing, which is icon.png. Now, that's okay that I'm doing that because I know I'm only going to be using one of these folders. So because they're all named icon, remember, I can access this from Java with r.drawable because they're in the drawable folder, and then the file name without the extension. So this simple app is just going to load an image view, which will display a little picture of a box. However, the box that's displayed is dependent on the device. So if I run this, and I gotta wait for the Android simulator to load. So we'll move on while this is loading. So next, we're gonna talk about styles. So in all the code we've seen, we've basically been just specifying style with all these attributes. And a lot of times, that gets really redundant. You know, we seem to be giving everything a layout width of fill parent or wrap content. So the way we can get around this is with styles, which, as I mentioned, is kind of the CSS equivalent in Android. So all of these styles are going to be specified in the special res values folder, which, recall, we can create files of any file name containing anything we want. So is the simulator done loading? Ooh, just in time. Okay. So we're installing. Okay, so here I'm displaying a blue box, which is actually the icon that's loaded in this folder. So remember that going through the precedents, we know that, okay, we're at the qualifier that's density. So we have all of these that are density. So now we have a medium pixel density. Okay, so we've just eliminated the top two. High and low are definitely wrong, so they're gone. Next, while we're going through all of Google's qualifiers, we're going to find one for the trackball type or the navigation type. And here we say, okay, our device has a trackball. Now, this is something that I've specified using the AVD manager. So if I go into my AVD manager, so this is my single AVD. Now, if I click on edit, you see here that we have these hardware properties. And I have one called trackball support that I've given a value of yes. If you want to give other hardware specific options, remember you just have this drop down, and you can specify a value for each of these keys. So now it said we have a trackball. Okay, that means that this MDPI folder is not specific enough for the device, in which case we're not going to use it, so we have the trackball folder. And that's the image that's displayed to the user. So any questions on hardware-based resources? Yep?
Can you specify trackball, I guess, if your device doesn't have a trackball? Can you fool it to think that?
Oh, so you mean your AVD? Yes, so that's what I was just showing you here is if we go into here, we can say, okay, this AVD is emulating a device that has a trackball. So on an actual device, the device itself will tell you.
So what if you ran this on a device that didn't have a trackball? What would it show?
So now it's going to go through, it's going to find the qualifier for input type. It's going to say, okay, I have a trackball. Input type. However, this input type is not trackball. It could be something like D-pad or any other values on the slide, in which case it's going to say, okay, we can't use this because it's a contradiction, so we're going to fall back to the only remaining folder, which is MDPI. So the question was, what if it doesn't have a trackball? The answer being, we're not going to use a trackball folder because it's a contradiction. Yep?
Also a question on order of precedence. Mm-hmm. What if I am forgetful and don't provide an LDPI option, but I do put in HDPI and MDPI.
So the question is, what if I don't specify one of these DPIs, or even we're using a device that's like XHDPI? And the answer is Google will kind of fall back to the closest match, and that's kind of a process that's probably more intricate but detailed on the documentation page. These are just kind of the basics of what it's going
to
do.
Yes,
it's the basically the bottom line of this process is you're going to get a closest match.
In your main.xml file,
yep.
Do you already have the image view, and you have the source as an @drawable icon in there?
Mm-hmm.
So you also need to programmatically set the icon in there as well as putting it in your main.xml file?
So the question is, what is this Android source drawable icon thing? I just left this in there as kind of an illustration of what the attribute was. We're basically, whenever we load the app, we're basically going to ignore whatever this is and overwrite it immediately. So if we took out if we took out this attribute, it would be fine. And if we took out the part where we're programmatically modifying it, then it would just be this default icon. So they're basically, I basically put them both in there to show you how to load an icon with two different things.
Okay, so you don't need to do it programmatically.
No, you don't. You only need to do one of these things.
Okay.
Yeah, I just left them both in there for illustrative purposes. Yep. So do we have to specify all these resources for the projects in this course? The specification, we'll go into more detail about that, but you know, we're not expecting you to have 90 of these RES folders. It's more just if you have a high-density device, you can afford to show a higher-resolution image, so it might look nicer. But the spec, I don't believe the spec has anything about you need to support these devices. We just have a general idea. If it looks good on every device or every resolution, you should be fine. You know, this is more for optimizing more than displaying correctly. So when the application is compiled, what happens? Yeah, these are all going to have to be in the APK. So our single APK is what's going into the marketplace, and that can be downloaded onto a variety of devices. So yes, everything has to go into the APK. So you will have a larger file size if you're supporting a million different devices. Trade-off. All right, so moving right along to styles. So the syntax for defining a style is nothing like CSS, though I wish it were. So you have a single style element, and that's going to have children, each of which define a single item, where an item is kind of analogous to a CSS property, where you have a key and a value. So these items, we actually already know what they are, because they're just what we've been using as attributes to each of these elements. So if I had a button or text view or something, where I specify the Android layout width to be fill parent, if I wanted to create a style to do the same thing, I would create an item where the name was Android layout width, and then the content of the XML element was the value of the attribute. So that would just be fill parent. So what's really cool about these styles is they can actually inherit from each other, similar to CSS. So if you have a style called my style, and you have all these rules, but you want to have a special case of this style for just one element, and you don't really want to copy and paste the whole thing in, what you can do is have one style inherit all the properties of another style. So if I create a second style called myStyle.something, that's automatically going to inherit all of the properties of myStyle. So if you override them, then myStyle.something will have precedence. But if you don't specify it, then it will inherit from myStyle. So let's take a look at some styles. So this is here. That's not helpful. So here's my app, and I have three buttons. So the first button has a lot of these style properties applied via attributes. So this is kind of the traditional way we've been doing things. And notice that if I want to specify a lot of them, this file is going to get really big really fast. So the second button here is using a style that I've defined in a styles.xml file, which we'll look at next. But I have a style called button style. And recall the way we're accessing that, I have an element in that XML file called style. The file itself is not called style. The element is called style. And then the style name is going to be button style. And so here, for the third button, I've extended that style to be called button style.monospace. So I have two styles. So this third button is going to inherit all the properties of this second button. So let's take a look at my styles. So we're in values, styles.xml. So here's my first style, just called button style, and I've basically copied and pasted all the things I defined in the first button into here. So these two buttons are going to look exactly the same. The second style is extending this one. So we've only defined one more thing. In this case, we want the typeface to be monospace. So we want all of these color and size things, but in this case, we want to use a monospace font. So this will look perhaps as you would expect. Like this. So these first two buttons are exactly the same. Size is different because of the amount of text in the button. But here you'll notice that this third button has all the properties of the second button, and it has a monospaced font. So any questions on styles or how inheritance works? Yeah?
Can that be extended further?
So can that be extended further? Yeah. If you wanted to do dot something, dot something else, you can go as far as you want, as far as logic will allow. Yep? So we have here we're defining styles for each button. I believe there's probably a way to override the default style of a button. This is probably cleaner, just so you can see exactly what's going on. And it's a lot less typing than doing it in the XML itself. So there might be a way to do that. I would definitely prefer it this way, just because I prefer classes over the styling, the elements themselves in HTML. So I would prefer this way, but there probably is a way to override the default button style. Yep.
I think that's themes, which I don't understand, but I've seen.
Oh, sure. So those are called themes, which may or may not be something we look at later in the course. All right. So now animations. So again, Android animations are kind of analogous to the WebKit CSS3 animations that we took a look at earlier, which is nice. You just learn something once and it keeps applying. So these are a little more verbose, and then as I mentioned before, they'll be stored in res/anim for animation. So the way we're going to define our animations is we're going to have a set element. So everything in a set is going to be animated concurrently. So if you want multiple things to happen at the same time, you want to put them in the same set. When you're defining an animation, set must be the root element again. So everything in your animation is going to be a child of this set element. So the transitions. The transitions are just like what we saw in CSS3. We can change the alpha, so we can fade the element, change its opacity. We can change the scale, so we can blow it up or shrink it. We can translate it, so that'll move it to the left or right. Or we can rotate it to a specific number of degrees. Also important to note is that a set can contain sets. So if you want everything to be animated at once, but certain subsets animated at different times, you can do that. So the attributes are usually in the form of from something to something, where you don't have to specify both. So for alpha, to change the opacity with an animation, you're going to say from alpha to alpha. And then the value of that is going to be a number between 0 and 1, so it'll be a float. With scale, you can do the same thing. So you can alter the x scale and the y scale independently. Translate, you can go through a specific point on the screen, or you can say I want to move 50 pixels to the right. Rotate, you can just say from degrees to degrees, maybe support for radians. And for all of them, you can give each a duration and a start offset. So a duration is kind of required, because if you don't have a duration, you're just not going to see the animation because it'll be instant. The start offset is going to be the number of milliseconds that the animation starts relative to when the first animation in the set started. So if I give something a start offset of 500, then that element is going to start being animated 500 milliseconds after its parent set has started being animated. So that's where sets come in. They're really useful for timing. So now, once we have these animations defined in an XML file, we need to apply them to elements using Java. So just like we define these transitions in CSS and then apply them to elements with JavaScript. So to load an animation, we're going to use the class AnimationUtils, and it has a method called loadAnimation. Remember, we can access the animation with our r.anim and then our file name because it's not in the values folder. So once we have an animation object, we're going to call startAnimation on the view we want to animate. And we can also attach callbacks to these animations, so once the animation stops or is cycled or something, we can respond. So let's take a look at tween animations, which are much more mature than they sound. Haha, Tommy's so funny. Okay, so first let's look in our res anim, and I've defined three animations. So you'll notice because we're accessing these things with r.anim and then dot the file name, that if we want separate animations, we need to create a separate file for each. So our first animation. So don't worry about this interpolator thing quite yet. We'll take a look at that next. But here, we're going to be changing the opacity of the element. So we're going to go from an opacity of 1, and we're going to fade it to 0.5. So this is going to last 400 milliseconds, and with the start offset of 0, it's going to start immediately. So you notice that this is a child of a set, which has to happen. Our next animation, we're now defining two things. So the first is a translation. We're going to go 50 pixels kind of diagonal to the right, because we're moving positive in the x and y direction. So that's this way. So that's going to start immediately, and it's going to last 500 milliseconds. Next, we're going to animate to the top left, the same amount. And you'll notice that this has the same duration, but a start offset that's equal to the duration of the first. So this means that this animation is going to start as soon as the previous animation has finished. Finally, again, just a simple one thing. We're now changing the scale. So we're scaling everything two times. So the x and the y are going to be twice what they were before. And now we have this pivot x and pivot y. And that kind of defines the origin of the scale. So if this is currently defined in the top left of the button, if you gave it something like 50%, 50%, that would be the exact middle of the button. And that's going to define where it scales from. So if you're in the middle, kind of everything is going to grow out from the center. Right now, everything is going to grow out from the top left. So it's going to kind of do this instead of this, if that makes sense. It makes more sense when you see it. So now let's take a look at how we're applying these animations. This is a big swath of code. So here, we're first just using the find view by ID, and we're getting the button in the way we've seen with an ID. So we've noticed that each of these buttons has an ID of button 1, 2, or 3. We can take a look at the layout, so you believe me. Really simple. Each of these just has a unique ID. Didn't bother creating a style because I just copied and pasted it, but that's bad practice, so you should create styles. So after we get the button from the view with this find view by ID, we're just going to set an onClick listener. So just like we saw last week, we're just going to respond to a tap. And now we're going to use the AnimationUtils class to load an animation. So the first argument to this is going to be a context. So just like we saw with intents, kind of the from to analogy, this is going to be the context we're animating on this activity. So we just need to specify that in the first argument. And then next, we are giving it an animation. So we're getting that with rnm_animation1 because our file name is called animation1.xml. So now we can start the animation on this button. So we're doing the same thing for these first two, but we're doing a little more on this third. So here we have an animation callback. So as I mentioned, we can attach event handlers depending on what's going on with the animation. So in order for this to work, we have to override all three of these methods. So we don't want to do anything when the animation starts or repeats, because it's not repeating. So we can just leave that blank. However, when the animation ends, we want to change some properties of the button. So remember that animation 3 is doubling the size of the button, both in the x and the y. So once that animation finishes, we're now actually changing the button to be twice its size. So notice that with an animation, once it completes, the element is going to go right back to what it was with no transition back. So if we do this, the button is going to animate larger and it's going to stay larger. So let's take a look at what this looks like. Okay. So the first, I just have a fading button. So I click it, it fades, and it kind of jumps right back at you. So you notice that once an animation is complete, it doesn't automatically animate back. It just kind of goes back to the way it was instantly. So with our moving button, we don't have that problem because we defined going out, and then we defined an animation that brings us back to our original state. So when we click this, we're going to fly out, and we're going to fly right back in. So finally, with the scaling button, when I click it, we're going to double its size. The font gets a little weird just because like scaling button is larger than the button at some points. But if I click this again, it'll actually keep getting larger because we're actually changing the size of the button. So that's a way with animation callbacks to kind of get around this notion of once the animation finishes, the button is back to where it was by changing what the button is after the animation completes. So any questions on tween animations? So I didn't set an easing function. That's actually what we're looking at next, is all the different interpolation functions. Yep?
How do you
So how do you get to the graphical display when you're looking at a manifest file? So if you were back in Eclipse, and I open up the manifest file, down this little bottom here, there's different tabs where the XML tab, so the last one, is going to be the raw XML. And these different tabs will give you different graphical displays depending on what you're editing. I prefer just looking at the XML. But same deal for that the GUI editor when you want to drag and drop elements onto it. Down at the bottom here, there's a really small tab bar above another tab bar that determines what the view is. Oh, so how do you get the GUI? So that's not the manifest file. That's going to be the layout file. So if I open up the layout file, you'll see I have this main.xml and then this graphical layout. And I click this, and then there are my buttons. Yep?
So you change the properties of the button in programmatically, but is there a way that you can change the properties of the thing you're animating in the animation XML file itself?
So the reason... So we're modifying these elements after we animate, and that's the reason we are doing that. It's because an animation only defines what's happening to the element, and it can't actually change the properties of the element itself. So that's why Google provides these callbacks. So yeah, so the reason we're doing it like this is because that's how you have to do it. Yep?
And does it support 3D as well as 3D?
I believe so. The 2D ones tend to be a little simpler, but I'm pretty sure that you could do some cool 3D stuff. Other questions? Okay. So there's one more type of animation that we won't take a look at as thorough. Oh, no, before that, is the interpolators. So with our CSS3 transitions, we had all these different easing functions. So we could go linear the whole way through or kind of bounce around. So we can do the same thing in Android. So here I've just listed a few of them. Four that are kind of the most different. So what we've been using so far is just this accelerate-decelerate interpolator. So that's kind of the smooth effect where it starts off and just kind of like slows down, so it's a really smooth effect. But there's also something like bounce, which will literally bounce once the animation finishes. Linear interpolator, which is just going to animate at the same rate all the way through. And then the overshoot interpolator, which is kind of animate too much and then bounce back. So you can also create custom interpolators. So unlike CSS3, where we're limited to these functions they define for us, we can essentially create our own interpolation function by using all of the currently existing interpolation functions as starting points and just kind of modifying something like the speed it's moving linearly or the amount that it's going to bounce. So we access these built-in interpolators with this really nice syntax of @android:, and then /interpolator. So this interpolators are kind of special case because they're kind of buried. But let's take a look at the different interpolators I've listed. So here we're going to be applying the same animation to three different buttons. However, they're going to have different interpolation functions. So the animation is just moving left to right 200 pixels, and it's going to take 1 second to go all the way to the right and then 1 second to go all the way back. So for this first one, you'll notice we're using the linear interpolator function. So this is going to be just straight back and forth. Next is the bounce interpolator. So animation's the same. All we need to change is this interpolator attribute. And finally, the overshoot interpolator. So let's take just... So we can see what these actually look like. Let's take a look. So here are my three buttons. So if we click the linear button, it's the most boring of the three, just kind of bounces back and forth on the screen. If we click on the bounce button, it's going to bounce once it reaches the end of the animation. It's a pretty cool effect that's really easily achieved. And finally, overshoot, which I like, kind of animates too much and then snaps back into place. So for example, they call it the tension at which this is going to snap back into place is a property you can adjust in order to create a custom interpolation. So we can kind of modify this this overshoot interpolator, and we can change the amount that it's snapping back and forth. So how does it know to go back and forth? That is because we've defined, just like in the second button, we've defined two animations. So the first is going to go to the right for 1 second, and the second one is going to go to the left for 1 second, but the start offset is how long it took for the first one to complete. So notice that if we give it a positive x offset, it's going to the right, negative goes to the left, because the origin is in the top left of the screen. So how do we get into defining how the animations themselves behave? I don't have an example of this, but basically, instead of just saying translate, we can have a whole element for a translate interpolator, and then we can modify that, and then instead of just saying interpolator at Android NM whatever, we would just use the interpolator we just created. So other questions on tween animations? Yep?
Can this also be said using the designer?
Pardon? Oh, can these animations be set using the graphical designer? That's a good question, because I don't really like the graphical designer. I guess this is the best they give you. You can kind of have a nicer graphical view of the animations. That's a good question. I don't really like it, because I just prefer editing the XML. Maybe. It's not the most straightforward thing in the world, if so. Other questions on tween animations? Yep?
So the overshoot, it goes minus 200 in x direction. Can we make it go down in the y direction?
Yeah, so right now we're just moving in the x direction, but we can very easily modify that using, instead of the x delta attribute, we can just change that to y delta, and then it's going to move vertically instead of horizontally. So if we have both x and y in the same animation, it'll go at those two things at the same time. So we can move in anything, really. All right, so in addition to tween animations, we also have these things called frame animations. And so these are probably a little less relevant for the projects right now, but basically these can be used to animate drawable elements, so single images. So using something like a film reel of images, you can rapidly swap them out, to create literally an animation. So the syntax for this is going to be the same. You're going to have items, except we're now going to be children of an animation list instead of a set. And we can access drawable resources the same way as always with this at drawable slash the name. So finally, we'll talk about intents. So remember, these intents are used to trigger activities, broadcast receivers, services, so the other application components. So last week, we saw a really simple example where we went from one activity to another activity. Using this syntax, we create a new intent, and the constructor takes two arguments, the first of which being the context from which you're going, the second being where you're going. So where you are now, where you want to go. However, these can be more general. So intent objects are just containing a description of what action has to be performed and where it's coming from. So we can use these to trigger both actions within our app and within other apps. So to do that, we're going to use this overloaded constructor, where the first argument is going to be an action. So these are all constants defined by Android for us, where we can say intent.actionDial, and that's going to represent the general action of wanting to dial a phone number. So we can also do something like the general action of viewing some content or searching the web for something. So the URI is what's going to provide the data as to what exactly we're trying to do. So this is given in the format of just like a web URL, except we're going to say the scheme, which can be something like HTTP or TEL for a telephone number. Then the first is called the host programmatically, and everything after that is going to be a list called the path segments. And so those are the appropriate Java methods for accessing those parts of a URI. And finally, we have a category. So a category is a little more specific than an action. So this is something about the component that should be true. So for example, if we have a category browsable, we need to say that this component is something that could be invoked by a web browser. So it's not going to be something relying on something other than load this content. Or something like a launcher, which is feasibly, if someone were to put this on their home screen, this could be shown as the first activity, and it wouldn't be something like the middle of a 15 puzzle. So we can manage these programmatically with adding and removing a category. In addition to this URI, we can also pass additional data around activities. So we do this with what are called bundles. where a bundle is just a set of key value pairs. So there's a put extra method on every intent where you can define a key and a value. So when you get that bundle back, so now we're in the second activity that was called by this intent, we can call the getIntent method, and so now we're going to get the intent that called this activity. Now if we call getExtras, then we can get the bundle that was passed. So with this getExtras, we have a list of all these keys and values, and we can say getStringKey to get the value associated with the key. So we also have intent filters. So while these intents we just looked at allow you to open other apps from our app, intent filters are what's going to allow other apps to open our app. So we register these intent filters in AndroidManifest.xml. You'll remember that this is where we had to declare the existence of all of these activities. So we're also going to declare the existence of these intent filters, or things that other apps might want to access our app to do. So these are generally written in XML, not in Java, just for simplicity. So underneath an activity element, we can have an intent filter. And so we're going to define an action, data, and a category. So just like we just looked at, the action is going to be what's to be performed. The data is going to be the format of the URI. And the category is going to be the additional properties of this component. So if someone invokes our app via an intent filter, and we want to access that URI they gave us, we can call getIntent and then getData. And so that's going to be a URI object that we can manipulate to get data from. So we can also use these intent filters to open activities from within our own app. So if we give each action some unique name, then we can just pass that name to the intent constructor, and our app is going to know that we're just going to switch into another activity within our app. So this is a lot less verbose than our original method, and maybe a little clearer to someone reading the code. So let's take a look at intent filters so that other apps can access our app. So here I've created a pair of applications. So let's look at the second one first. So this first app, or named the second app, is going to be the app that responds to someone else. So our first app is going to open this app from within it. So in this app, first we're getting the intent URI. So as I mentioned, we can get the data with getIntent.getData, and we now have a URI object representing the URI that this other app passed us. So from this URI, we want to access the phone number they passed us. So this is kind of overriding the dialer. So when someone tries to dial a number, they'll be presented with an option to look at our app instead of the default dialer. And so we've said that there's going to be a number defined in this URI. In this case, it's going to be the only thing in the URI. So it's going to be the host. So a little caveat, it's not immediately obvious, is this path segments thing does not include the host. So if you're trying to get all the path segments and you're like, where's my first element? It's because it's in this getHost method. So now we're just setting the contents of a text view to whatever the other app passed us. So in order to do this, we need to define some intent filters. So here's the first intent filter that already existed in our app, and that was created by Android for us. And that just says that from the launcher, this is something that you can launch from the launcher. So the way Android knows what apps to have on that launcher menu where all your apps are is it looks at all the Android manifest files of all your apps, and if it contains this thing saying that it can be launched from the launcher and that this would be the main activity when you first launch it, then it's going to put it there. So we've created another intent filter. If we overrode this one, that means we couldn't launch it from the home screen, which wouldn't be good. So we've created a new one that says we want to respond to the dial action. So if any app ever tries to dial something, we want to be there to respond to it. So we've given this data scheme, we've defined this data scheme. So all we want is a telephone number. So we can just say all we want is a tel. So the tel is going to be preceded by some number or some value. So now let's take a look at this other app. So very simple, we're just using this new syntax for invoking an intent. So we're creating a new intent with this action dial constant that's defined in the Android intent class for us. and then we're sending it a URI. So we can't just send it a string. We need to send it a URI object. So a quick way to convert between the two is just URI.parse, and then give it a string. So see here that this tell, you remember that was the scheme we're using. So tell is our scheme, and then this number is going to be our host. So from here, we can just start activity with this intent. So let's take a look at what this looks like. And I need to install this one first. So here you'll see we have this message, maybe not the nicest error handling in the world, but it says URI is null. So if we just tried to run this without this little sanity check of intent URI not equals null, we're going to get this angry message from Android saying that we crashed unexpectedly. And that's because we're trying to call get host on null, which is not the best idea. So here we're just making sure that we actually were passing intent URI, and we're changing how we respond to the user launching our app accordingly. So now let's install this other app, which, as I mentioned, is just going to immediately try to dial a phone number. And I hit back too soon. So let's just clear everything. And now let's run this second app. Cool. So now we've just tried to dial a phone number. And now Android has said, oh, wait, there's more than one app on this device that wants to respond to this intent dial. So we're presented with a list of apps to respond to. So if we just click this phone, then we've now just launched another app from within our app. And so the phone app has populated the number accordingly. If we use our other app, so we go back, launch it again. So we click our Section 4 app. We now invoke the activity we just defined that just displays to the user what number they tried to dial. So that's it for section today. If there are any questions on intent filters before we end. All right, if not, then good luck as you begin your projects, and I will see you for the walkthrough on Thursday.